Hello, welcome to Illinois Radio Reader. This is Lisa bringing you the News Gazette today, February 4th, 2026. Hope you're having a great start to your day. We're going to start on the front page today, and we have a picture of a line of cheerleaders with the heading Strike a Pose, Boys Basketball, Central 56, Urbana 52. And it says under the picture, Champaign Central cheerleaders welcome their team onto the floor at the start of Tuesday night's Big 12 matchup against Urbana. The Maroons overcame a 12-point deficit with 6 minutes remaining to clinch the road win 56-52. At the top of the page is an article with the heading, Deputy Clerk Unafraid of Hard Tasks Like Parenting. That's what she said. Patton, one of 9 women speaking this Saturday, by Luke Taylor. Angie Patton has never struggled to ask hard questions or hold tough conversations. The ability has carried her through her career, first as a journalist, then a communications specialist, and now as a chief deputy Champaign County clerk. It also probably helped her while parenting her 4 children through their teenage years, which is what she plans to discuss during her part of this year's That's What She Said event. Nothing really prepares you for the parenting of teenagers, particularly moms, Patton said. It's a very intense experience. They're getting their independence, and then they leave, and it's like, don't forget to send money, Patton said. She will speak alongside a group of other women during That's What She Said at 2 and 7 p.m. Saturday at the Parkland College Theater. The event brings together a new group of local women each year to discuss their personal experiences. These stories are often very emotional, but Patton said she wasn't about to be on stage crying. Instead, she plans to focus more on the humorous side of her topic, even if she recommends bringing some tissue for her fellow speakers' presentations. This year's event also features Carolyn Blair, Shauna Claiborne, Jan Eckert, Maggie Grindstaff, Jacqueline Warakel Kipeni, Susan Northrup, Candy Reeder, and Ashley Rhodes. Patton started off her career in journalism, inspired to work on personal profiles since writing has been a talent and a love of hers since she was young. I was somebody that knew how to have conversations with people. I knew how to have hard conversations, Patton said. I wasn't like Woodward and Bernstein, I know that. I just knew I could write compelling stories that were interesting, and I never had a lack of ideas. Even so, she found herself writing about her heavier topics that she started to feel she wasn't quite prepared for. I realized I didn't want to become a single person that may have had a significant drinking problem, Patton said. I was like, I think I need to get out of this new business. So she did, and finding work at the Illinois State Archaeological Survey, working in communications and helping to publicize the work going on. The Archaeological Survey merged into the Prairie Research Institute, and she continued her work there, but it wasn't a permanent fit. People think that working at the university, and it's great that it's here, is like the pinnacle. But I got very bored toward the end, and I was ready for something different, Patton said. Champaign County Clerk Aaron Ammons was elected in November 2018, started out without a chief deputy clerk. Patton took on the position in February of 2019, just months before the April election. She was proud and excited to work for the first African American, as well as the first Democrat, to hold the office. This is an office where we're catching a lot of people, they're having babies, they're getting married, they're picking up death certificates, paying delinquent taxes, elections, Patton said. It's kind of a hotbed over here, so I'm never bored. It solved that for sure. Now she found herself on the other end of the news cycle. Any mistake that went down in the office where she worked could end up on the front page or on the TV. That, combined with starting with only a few short months before an election, made the job very stressful. She doesn't think she cried every day, but close enough. On top of that, Patton said she and her co-workers came in with very little guidance from their predecessors and found themselves making the manuals on how to run the clerk's office. The learning curve was very, very steep and very, very difficult. But like most things, the things that are stretching you and growing you, while it is the most uncomfortable process ever, when I look back at my time here, this will be the thing that I'm most proud of, Patton said. Meanwhile, throughout her career, she was raising those kids. Four kids. The youngest is still in college, already working with large companies for art and design, and the other three work as a teacher, a research scientist, and in billing, respectively. They're all off and successful in their very different fields, which Patton believes were a result of the freedom she and her husband allowed them. Through it all, she thought her kids might have been a bit more concerned about her career. The reality is, I'm sure they're proud of me, but what really mattered to them was when I was home, when I was available, and all of that, Patton said. Parenting teenagers isn't really different from parenting a newborn. They're just a lot more attitude than they have. Continuing on our front page, an article about the U.S. Postal Service. The heading, Officials Area Mail Delivery Returning to Normal. Customers asked to make sure path to their mailbox clear. By Jana Wiersema. As of Tuesday morning, Champaign resident David Summers had yet to receive any mail since Thursday, including daily issues of the News Gazette, which switched to U.S. Postal Service delivery in early 2024. My issue right now is that we're trying to get all of our W-2s, Summers said. About 10 a.m. I'm sure they're in the mail somewhere. Summers finally received his mail about 11 a.m., but noted that while his Friday and weekend papers were there, the Tuesday edition was not. I didn't get any of the Tuesday's mail, that's my guess, he said. Postal Service spokesman Tim Norman provided the following statement. The U.S. Postal Service delivers mail in severe weather conditions to maintain our commitment to providing reliable service to every address we serve, including critical items such as medications, government correspondence, and essential supplies. The Postal Service continuously monitors weather conditions and reinforces safety guidance to help ensure employees can deliver mail as safely as possible while continuing to provide delivery to our customers. Mail service issues in the 618 zip code area are being resolved. The Postal Service has taken appropriate steps to restore normal operations, and mail delivery in the area is now proceeding as expected. USPS will continue to monitor service to ensure consistent and reliable delivery for customers. USPS would like to remind customers the importance of keeping walkways, sidewalks, and areas around mailboxes clear from snow and ice, so letter carriers can provide safe and timely mail delivery. Snow and patches of ice in front of mailboxes can make it difficult for letter carriers to safely deliver the mail. Residents maintaining a clear path to the mailbox, including steps, porches, walkways, and street approach, will help letter carriers maintain consistent delivery service. Customers receiving curbside delivery should also ensure clear access to their mailboxes for letter carriers who deliver from the street. Generally, a car length approach and another car length to exit. The 618 zip code area comprises most of Champaign, Piatt, and Douglas counties, as well as the eastern part of the DeWitt County, Norman said. Summers wasn't the only one experiencing issues with mail service. The News Gazette turned to its Facebook followers Tuesday morning to see if anyone else had seen problems. As of 3:30 p.m., the post had netted around 75 comments from individuals in areas such as Champaign, Urbana, Rantoul, Tolono, Hoopston, Villa Grove, and St. Joseph. Make sure that they can get to your mailbox, Camilla Smith commented. We just got almost a week's worth of mail after we shoveled a path out in front of our mailbox. The slew of comments included complaints about mail not being delivered in a timely fashion, including issues of the News Gazette, mail being delivered to the wrong address, mail being delivered late in the day, pieces of mail that traveled confusing routes on their way to from point A to point B, for example. Lewis Lai said one priority mail letter took 5 weeks to get from Champaign to Glen Ellen, with a stop in Dallas in between. We're going to continue under our communities to Section A5 with an article with the heading Illinois Agribusiness Network Summit, two named for inaugural professional awards by Rob Lacates. The Illinois Agribusiness Network awarded its inaugural class of professional awards during the organization's summit at the iHotel on Tuesday afternoon. The two awardees, Jim Goss and Ailey Elmore Bird, were congratulated in front of more than 110 others for their professional and emerging professional awards, respectively. Goss started as a boy who knew sows, cows, and plows. The now figured head in farm management for Central Illinois made a reluctant career shift from farmer to banker early in his life during the mid-1980s farm crisis. He stayed determined to still work with farmers, so he adapted. He changed his trajectory and pursued a business administration's degree from Illinois State University. Utilizing his agribusiness knowledge, he picked up along the way to launch his ongoing 37-year career. During his acceptance speech, through a brief emotional pause after seeing his wife crying joyful tears when thanking her, he said he doesn't foresee his career ending for at least another 10 years. He said he would stop when he stopped having fun. "I don't think my wife's that excited about that, but I'm having the time of my life," he said. "When work is not work, that's pretty special. That's when you know you've made it." And it hasn't felt like work to him. He derives enjoyment from being the de facto consultant for many farmers day to day. He gets to help the landowner and farmer relations and help upkeep the land owned by a family since the 1850s. I'm a pretty humble guy in that. I mean that there were a ton of people sitting in this room that were just as deserving as me, he said. The Illinois State University graduate worked at the Atkins Group, a business managing more than 15,000 acres of farmland in Illinois and central Iowa, for 25 years. The company merged with People's Company in May of 2024, making the Atkins location for Illinois office, and Goss has been with the parent company for almost 2 years. Goss also served on the Champaign County Chamber of Commerce Agribusiness Committee Board for 31 years and still is on to this day. He was a Champaign County Board member from 2017 to 2023 and on the Farm Bureau Foundation Board for between 2000 to 2017. He said that what brings him the most fulfillment is just the ability to be able to take something I love in agriculture and help people that maybe don't have quite the same love, but have fond memories of what their land used to be when their grandfather took them to the farm to help people. Amy Elmore Bird received the Emerging Agribusiness Professional Award in between agriculture and finance classes during her busy teaching schedule at the U of I College of ACES. Hailing from Montgomery County, her family farm stands just south of Springfield. She grew up there and was incredibly passionate about agriculture from the get-go. Her father owns a smaller community bank in Litchfield, and she remembered going to the office with him, listening to him talk with farmers. I would sit there and play with a stack of $1 bills, or whatever he gave me that day, and a few tractors, he said. She said, he's the reason I was really inspired to get into the agriculture finance business. Elmore Bird studied at Lincoln Land Community College and then transferred to the U of I. During her undergrad, she worked alongside Bruce Sherrick as a teaching assistant, and education stuck. She continued working with Sherrick for her graduate degree, researching farmland markets. After graduation, she spent 2 years as an academic professional with a focus in farm management that was then hired as an instructor, where she has been for 3 years. Sarah Lowe, her boss, nominated her for the honor. She received the call from Kirk Bilta, the executive director of the Champaign County Farm Bureau, last week, which she said left her distraught. Elmer Bird said the most exciting part of the award is being recommended by people she knew and the feeling of validation. "It's very exciting. I think the most rewarding part is to be recommended by the people who mentored you and the people who have come to really look up to you in this space," she said. "You get the recognition from those types of people that you've looked up to for so long, and they think you're doing a good job. It's just nice to have that." Seeing how energized and eager her students are to learn keeps her in teaching. A good amount of her students in agriculture classes come from rural farms and do not have a global perspective on the industry. Her definition of success is a simple one: watching her students succeed. A student of hers attended the award ceremony, whom Elmer Bird met in her first freshman semester, and noticed that she was shy. The instructor clocked her passion for agriculture and felt lots of potential and capabilities radiating from her. Now the senior is moving to Washington post-graduation, and she bets her students will be a future Secretary of Agriculture because she just has that amount of potential. Some of my students, their goal is to go back and run their family farm, and when they get to do that, that's what makes me feel like I've succeeded at my job. And there are some pictures of these recipients of the Agribusiness Professional Award, shaking the hands of Kirk Bilta, Executive Director of Champaign County Farm Bureau, Tuesday at the Ike Hotel. Bird stopped by between her agriculture and finance classes that she teaches at the University of Illinois to receive her award. Let's head over now to J. Mark Powell with his Holy Cow history. And there are two pictures, vintage pictures. One of Jesse Woodson James, the outlaw, and the other, Jesse Tim Edwards James, the son. And the article has the heading, "The Railroading of an Outlaw's Son." The fruit doesn't fall far from the tree. They say, more than a century ago, investigators desperately hoped that it would prove in a big criminal case, that it would prove true. As we're about to discover, things didn't work out that way. It all started on a February in late September of 1898. Gunmen robbed the express car of a Missouri Pacific Railroad train near Leeds, Missouri. The express car was where valuables were kept, and it's believed that bad guys got away with a bundle. Some sources say the haul was about $40,000, more than a million in today's money. The railroad bosses brought the agents in from Pinkerton National Detective Agency. It was the world's largest private law enforcement agency at the time. Its services came with a hefty price tag, meaning the rail carrier wasn't fooling around. It was paying big bucks, and it expected big results. Leeds was a neighborhood in the southeast section of Kansas City, then, as now, a municipality infamous for its casual relationship with law and order. The Pinkertons began snooping around and asking questions. In that time, long before Miranda rights were ever heard of, and the company's detectives were known for sweating witnesses in hotel rooms, grilling them until they got the answers that they wanted to hear, one way or another. The investigators quickly zeroed in on what would today be called a person of interest. William W. Lau was a railroad switchman. When investigators put the screws on him during a particularly heated sweating session, he folded like a cheap suit. Lau fingered Tim Edwards as the brains behind the holdup, which was music to the Pinkertons' ears because they knew Tim Edwards was an alias. Edwards was actually Jesse Edward James, the son of the legendary outlaw Jesse James. Born in 1875, he was only 6 years old when his father was shot from behind in the family's rented house in St. Joseph, Missouri, on an April morning in 1882. Already a national celebrity by then, the elder James' murder capitulated him into American folklore. Among his many crimes, he and his gang were credited with committing the first train holdup in 1873 near Adair, Iowa. Now his son was being accused of the same thing. But the boy was nothing like his dad. He added Tim to his middle name, posing as Tim Edwards to conceal his identity as he grew up with his widowed mother and sister in Kansas City. Although it was an open secret around town who he really was, in 1898 he was 23 years old, ran a cigar store, and kept a low profile. The Pinkertons could barely contain their glee. Nabbing the son of the greatest outlaw in American history would make his trial national news. They licked their chops in anticipation of the headlines. However, there was a problem, and it was a big one. Not only did Jesse E. James insist he knew nothing about the crime, but there was also no evidence linking him to it. All the Pinkertons had to go on was one confession. That was enough. The mere public speculation that another James was somehow involved looked bad in the court of public opinion. The younger James was arrested in October and charged with complicity in the robbery. Just as expected, the trial made news from coast to coast when it began in early 1899. Also as expected, the case against James fell apart almost immediately. The prosecutor had nothing to go on. No evidence, no credible witnesses, not even a motive, just a last name. Jurors didn't buy it. James was quickly acquitted. We made up our minds that the police had picked out this boy to railroad him to the penitentiary, and we wouldn't stand for it, the jury foreman said afterward. As for Lau's testimony, another juror added, we believed he was a liar. We simply threw it out. One error from news coverage of the trial took on a life of its own. Because of the similarity in their names, the son was incorrectly identified as Jesse James Jr. and is still frequently called that today. There was no Jr. The dad was Jesse Woodson James, and the boy was Jesse Edwards James. At that point, Jesse E. James realized the futility of continuing to use the alias and adopted his real name for the rest of his life. He later became a successful lawyer. Although in the manner of speaking, he did have a brief criminal career of his own. He played his famous father in two silent movies in the early 1920s. The father of four daughters, Jesse E. James, died quietly in his sleep at age 75 in 1951. Let's continue on in our communities in Section A8, an article from Urbana from the 5th District Appellate Court. Hirschfield children appeal recent estate ruling. Attorney for their stepmother says they're trying to rewrite family history. An estate dispute, it's connected, that has continued for more than a decade isn't over yet. The children of John Hirschfield are appealing a recent order by Champaign County Judge Chad Beckett, who ruled in favor of their stepmother, Mary, to the 5th District Appellate Court. The notice of appeal, which was filed Friday, seeks to have the order reversed and appropriate damages awarded to Hirschfield's children. Daniel Thies, one of the attorneys representing Mary in this matter, told the News Gazette that Beckett's ruling was thorough and complete. He also cited Beckett's finding that the plaintiffs failed to prove deliberate malintent on Mary's part and that she had shown exhaustive devotion in caring for her husband. As a result, Mary prevailed at trial and there was no recovery by the children, Thies said. The Hirschfield children's unwillingness to accept these facts, even after they have had their day in court and even in the face of the overwhelming evidence, is hard to understand. The children plainly had a complicated and at times combative relationship with their father. The way they have pursued this case looks more and more like an effort to rewrite that family history, with Mary as collateral damage. Laura Hollis, John Hirschfield, Christopher Hirschfield, Jennifer Ryan, Adam Hirschfield, Catherine Murphy, and Robert Hirschfield, John's children by his first wife, Rita, claimed that Mary, John's second wife, took advantage of his worsening health to divert assets to herself that would be otherwise part of his estate after he died on November 30th of 2014. Mary, on the other hand, argued that any benefit or asset she received during the marriage was the result of John's actions, his explicit direction, or a plan that was put in place by John, albeit carried out by Mary, at the time when he was competent to do so, Beckett said. He wrote that the Hirschfield children's citation to cover assets initially proceeded concurrent with their attempt to contest the will, which was filed in June of 2015. That will contest proceeding was previously dismissed with prejudice by this court, and that dismissal was upheld on appeal, Beckett said. The citation proceedings were similarly discussed with prejudice by this court. However, that dismissal was reversed on appeal. A trial on the citation case was held in the spring of 2025. While Beckett also ruled in favor of Mary in his January 5, 2026 order, he did find that she executed a number of inadequately justified transactions after John became impaired. Still, he found that the total value of these questionable transactions, estimated to be roughly $302,000, was insufficient to affect any change in the disposition of John's estate. And also on that page, there's an article from Champaign County Sheriff about a St. Joseph woman struck by a pickup truck while walking her dog. A St. Joseph woman walking her dog was hospitalized after being struck by a vehicle Tuesday morning, a few blocks east of the village's downtown. Champaign County Sheriff's deputies were dispatched about 5:50 a.m. to the intersection of East Warren and Stout Streets for a report of a crash involving a vehicle and a pedestrian. The investigation showed that a 2015 pickup truck driven by 40-year-old St. Joseph man was turning north onto Stout from Warren when it struck a pedestrian walking her dog in a crosswalk. The pedestrian, 52-year-old woman, was from St. Joseph, and she was taken to a local hospital with serious but non-life-threatening condition and injuries. The driver of the pickup truck was given a traffic citation. And there's a picture on this page of a very busy construction site, which the heading says, surrounded by taller buildings and looking like a transplanted construction site from a large city, work has begun on a new student apartment complex at 201 East Green Street in the campus town area of Champaign. Plans call for a 15-story high-rise mixed-use residential building. And we have an article with Capital Connection with the title, Illinois Child Care Assistance Program Funding Freeze Could Worsen Shortage in State, Providers Say. Pamela Franks, owners of Playful Steps Child Care, has been taking care of low-income children and their families in her Springfield home for more than 30 years. Frank has a bachelor's degree in social work and a master's degree in early childhood education, and she's made child care her career. Now she takes care of 8 children. Because she provides the care in her home, Frank is the cook, nurse, teacher, counselor, and marketer. She doesn't have any staff and doesn't want to hire any. To make it all work, Frank said, both she and the families she works with rely on Illinois Child Care Assistance Program, the state-run program that provides families with financial assistance for child care costs, also known as CCAP. The subsidy program allows low-income families to get the same amount of quality care that higher tax bracket families would get, Frank said. Funding for CCAP comes from a mix of state funds and federally funded grant programs like the Child Care and Developmental Fund, the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, or TANF. But the funding of those programs is now under threat. In early January, the Trump administration froze $10 billion in child care subsidy funds for Illinois and 4 other Democratic-led states. The freeze affected about $1 billion for Illinois. The administration said it was because of suspicions about fraud, but provided no detail or proof. But the 5 blue states targeted in the freeze say it's a political move, and they already protect against fraud, and the administration intentionally gave them an impossible task on an impossible timeline. Federal judges have twice issued temporary restraining orders on the freeze. The current order will end Friday. Frank has been preparing for a potential permanent freeze by cutting some of the services she provides, like digital communications or not buying equipment. I'm trying to see if I can have a few reserves, but those reserves would only keep maybe my business open for 1 more month if the federal freeze happens, she said. Frank said she's been preparing the families she takes care of. They told her that they would be devastated if she closed because without childcare, they would have to quit their jobs, and many of them don't have family or other support nearby. Going to another provider or center would likely not work for them because either Springfield and the state at large has a childcare provider shortage, and bigger providers rely on the subsidies too. Most of the programs that I have in my community take the subsidy program, Frank said. So even daycare centers, they would have to shut their doors. Some of the reasons for the shortage in Illinois and nationwide go back to childcare business closures during the pandemic, according to recording of that time. We're going to end this first half hour of the News Gazette, and I'll be back shortly.